This is The Guardian.
Terrifying tensions in the Middle East have got worse thanks to Iran's retaliatory attack on Israel, and the former Prime Minister, who's now the Foreign Secretary, has been tying himself in a few knots.
What would Britain do if a hostile nation flattened one of our consulates?
Well, we would take, we would take the very strong action.
And Iran would say that that's what they did.
Meanwhile, domestic politics has been restored to sanity and stability by the return of another former PM.
And they talked about ferrets so much that I was not even able to speak.
Also, the UK is set to ban cigarette sales to adults of different ages, and Nigel Farage and Suella Braverman have been deplatformed by the Mayor of Brussels. What a time to be alive. I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics with the UK for The Guardian. Joining me today are The Guardian columnist Gabby Hinsliff and Lord Peter Ricketts, crossbench peer and former National Security Advisor to David Cameron and Undersecretary for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. We're going to spend the first half of this episode talking about the situation in the Middle East and the UK's involvement in it, and then we'll look at some of the big and, it has to be said, rather ludicrous domestic political stories that are around this week. Let's talk, first of all, about the UK's involvement in the Middle East. Leaders from all over the world have this week been calling for Israel and Iran to de-escalate after Iran launched 300 missiles and drones at Israel over the weekend in response to an attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria. The vast majority of those missiles and drones obviously did not get through. In response to an attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria, countries including the UK were involved in intercepting the attack. The Royal Air Force, for example, was reported to have shot down Iranian drones. This is what Rishi Sunak said in a statement to the House of Commons on Monday.
In support of Israel's own defensive action, the United Kingdom joined a US-led international effort, along with France and partners in the region, which intercepted almost all of the missiles, saving lives in Israel and its neighbours. We sent additional RAF Typhoons to the region as part of our existing operations against Daesh in Iraq and Syria.
So clearly we know the UK was involved in this. First question is how you both feel about that.
What we learned from Rishi Sunak was that this wasn't the UK just jumping into air defence of Israel from a standing start. This was actually part of an operation that we've probably all forgotten about, called Operation Shader, which is the anti-ISIS air campaign that's been running since 2014. UK airplanes have been involved with that, as have the French, as well as the Americans. And it seems what the Americans asked was for us to backfill their effort in that campaign.
Yes.
When they pulled their aircraft off to go to the air defense of Israel.
Okay, but that still doesn't detract from the fact that the context is different, right? And this is British military involvement in something which may go in any one of several directions subsequently. And the question then arises, what may be our involvement in those things?
Yes.
You can see why people are asking that question.
Absolutely right. But this was part of an existing operation. I suspect that the judgment in London was, when the Americans asked that, it was better to show that we were rallying to Israel's support in this case of a massive attack. And I don't think it has any consequences for how things might develop. If Israel goes back with a heavy retaliation against Iran, I don't think either the Americans or the British will want to be part of that. So this is a limited operation at the moment, and I think they were right to respond positively to that American request.
Gabby?
I have to say I agree with Peter. I think this was a minimal risk operation. It feels, although it was risky and although this is a very tense moment and although, you know, both sides are sort of gambling on what comes next, it feels to a certain extent like a quite choreographed intervention, in that the Iranians telegraphed their intentions a long time in advance, certainly long enough that the Americans could get all their ducks in a row and everything in place. It feels to me as, you know, the Iranians were trying to make this a contained attack rather than something that could explode in lots of different directions.
Yeah, yeah. The operation is concluded, was the Iranian language, right?
That may not be how Israel feels, but, you know,
that's the next. So that's the next question. Joe Biden says, take the win, we are told, to the Israeli government. But I wonder, Peter, as someone who knows a lot about this and is watching it very closely, you must be sitting here now waiting to find out what Israel's going to do. And I wonder what your feeling is about what form that will take, if any. They're not just going to sit there and do nothing, are they?
I think that's unlikely. I agree. I mean, just following up from what Gabby said, this was still a very, very risky move by Iranians.
Yeah, yeah.
It could well have been that some of these missiles, even if headed for Israeli military facilities, had misfired and hit a hospital or a school. Then we would be into a massive escalation right now. There is a moment of opportunity here if Netanyahu can find the statesmanship to say, we now have an alliance in the region with moderate Arab states and Europeans and Americans supporting us against Iran. Take that win, as Biden said, move back to Gaza, get a ceasefire there. The Israeli diplomatic and military position is transformed.
Yeah, but I grimly guffawed a moment ago, precisely, I think, in anticipation of what you're about to say, which is you just mentioned Benjamin Netanyahu finding some statesmanship, right? We're not in this mess because of Benjamin Netanyahu's familiarity with statesmanship, are we?
Using those two words in the same sentence, I agree, is risky. If you want my guess, he will not settle for calling quits at this point. I suspect he will want some further form of retaliation. But he's got a spectrum of options going from relatively contained right up to the very, very escalatory moves against Iranian infrastructure and or their nuclear sites. And I think the war cabinet in Israel is split. I know that David Cameron is out there at the moment pushing for a more statesmanlike response. We will see how it plays out, but I do fear this is not over yet.
Right, you just mentioned David Cameron a moment ago, so let's talk about him and UK foreign policy more broadly. It is quite striking that the last time the UK Parliament had the chance to vote on military action was in 2013 when David Cameron was the Prime Minister and wanted the UK to join US-led airstrikes in Syria. He was quite dramatically voted down at that point. 30 MPs rebelled on his own side. That was because of these things that still swirl around our politics about the Middle East and British intervention going back to Iraq and Afghanistan. To what extent, Gabby, is that still sort of here politically when we start to talk about British involvement, however limited and choreographed in the Middle East?
I think for some people, those ghosts will always linger. I do think, I mean, if the reasons I said before, I think this is a very different operation. And I remember, the one thing I remember about that, the night of that vote, which was a kind of a quite traumatic night in the Commons, actually. A lot of MPs at the end, you could see thinking, what have we quite just done? Because I don't think there was a, you know, it was a chaotic sort of jumble of amendments by the end. The procedure got so complicated, half the MPs barely sure what they were voting on. And there was a sort of feeling of dissatisfaction at the end of it. But in those days, back in 2013, there was this really strong memory of our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan and this fear of being bounced. That's what was the worst thing about that vote, you know, was the feeling that the Americans had very suddenly said, right, we're doing this, you've got to be on board. And the opposition in particular, Miliband and Simon, saying, well, you know, we are not being bounced again by the Americans into something. There's less of that feeling around this vote.
Nodding,
but for, you know, for many people listening to this podcast, you know, just the words UK intervention in the Middle East triggers, you know, unpleasant memories. But I do think it's different than the 2013 operation, and it's different than, you know, 20 years ago.
Peter, you've worked with David Cameron. In his new role as Foreign Secretary, it is interesting to think about and speculate about what is driving him. As far as the Middle East is concerned, in the wake of October the 7th, that long 6 months that has followed it, it was said that he was striking noticeably, albeit somewhat subtle, postures which were different from that ironclad, automatically pro-Israeli, unconditional support that we've tended to expect from the Foreign Office. Certainly after Margaret Thatcher, there was talk of him reviving the Arabist tradition in the Foreign Office and so on. Do you think that's sort of where he is?
Well, I think when David Cameron came into office, it was just a few weeks after October the 7th. And I think he probably felt that the UK position had been pretty hesitant, pretty unclear. Rishi Sunak had not been prepared to go out and take a very strong stand other than a kind of knee-jerk support for Israel's right to self-defense. And I think his concept of the role of Foreign Secretary, he's there for a limited time, almost certainly. He wants to get a distinctive British voice back into foreign affairs. He wants to be out there, active, high-profile, influential. And I think he saw straight away that there were two things he had to do. One was Ukraine. The other was to take a much more hard-edged position on the humanitarian crisis developing in Gaza.
Right.
And he's put the focus on that very much from the beginning. I think he's on his fifth or sixth visit to the Middle East now.
But do you think he heralds a less unconditional approach to Israel, given where we are?
Well, I think there's a less unconditional approach to Israel
in general.
In the other, you know, in the rest of politics, I think there is a solid core in the Conservative Party that is absolutely staunchly pro-Israel. But I think in public opinion, you can feel that the Palestinian cause, you know, is much more prominent as a result of what's happened in Gaza. And I think David Cameron, who is a long-time supporter of Israel, has sensed this mood and knows that stability in the Middle East in the longer term lies through getting a solution to the Palestinian problem, using our long-time support for Israel to leverage that, and then working for Israel to integrate into the region with deals with its moderate Arab neighbours.
Okay. All that apart, David Cameron came a little bit undone when he was speaking to Kay Burley on Sky News earlier this week about the Iranian response to Israel's earlier attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. This is what happened.
What would Britain do if a hostile nation flattened one of our consulates?
Well, we would take, we would take the very strong action.
And Iran would say that that's what they did?
Well, what they did, as I said, was a massive attack.
So they were right to respond, but they overreacted, is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that the attack they carried out was on a very large scale, much bigger than people expected.
Did they have a right to respond?
Well, countries have a right to respond when they feel they've suffered an aggression. Of course they do. But look at the scale of that response.
Not sure anyone in the Western world, on the sort of British-American end of this, has got any right to be holding forth about proportionate responses and so on, given our foreign policy record, or, you know, war record over the last 15 or 20 years. There's an awkwardness about that position, isn't there?
I didn't feel that's the awkwardness he's feeling there. I think the awkwardness he's feeling there is trying to say something that's going to be heard in Tehran and Tel Aviv and not offend either side. And not, I don't think he's thinking, oh my God, Britain doesn't have a leg to stand on here. And I think the biggest problem for me with the UK involvement in repelling those drone strikes isn't necessarily what the UK did in this case. It's what the UK hasn't done in other cases. It's the argument that, oh, you know, the minute there are missiles, someone fires a rocket at Tel Aviv, you're right there. But did we intervene to stop however many bombs falling on Khan Yunis? No, of course we didn't. We didn't even provide this degree of air defence cover to Ukraine. The trouble with this action is that it telegraphs something about our intentions and our allegiances around the world. And then other countries start asking, well, why do we not occupy the same, you know, space in your head that Israelis do?
Let's talk about so-called de-escalation. It seems that every country that's a player in this crisis, the US, UK, France, United Nations more generally, are calling on Israel and Iran to somehow calm the situation. Peter, you know about these things. Give us a sense of how Israel will or won't feel that international pressure and what effect it might have.
Well, the Israelis will always say that they take their own decisions, but they have to take some account, particularly of what the Americans are saying. I mean, America is their major economic partner. They're by far the largest supplier of their advanced weapons. And the rift between Biden and Netanyahu over Gaza got as deep as I can remember an American Israeli leader. They can't ignore that. Of course, Netanyahu has the pressures in his own cabinet with the right-wing ministers. But on this case, he has to calculate that if he goes for a heavy retaliation against Iran, he cannot expect the Americans to be part of that. And they will have a dilemma about how they then protect Israel from the next response from Iran, because they need to avoid the position where Israel feels it can act with impunity, that it can do whatever it likes and America will defend it. And I think there are limits of what America is prepared to do.
Okay. But you can't really meaningfully talk about de-escalation unless you have a bigger context for it as regards a sort of plan for the region of some description, some idea about how these tensions enduringly might be calmed, which will have to center on Palestine. Iran's drive to acquire nuclear weapons presumably will be part of that conversation. Do you get any sense of the first stirrings of that in any meaningful way? Because you can't just stand there and say de-escalate. There has to be a much bigger picture around it.
And to be fair to Antony Blinken and David Cameron, they have been working on a post-conflict situation in Gaza. Who is going to keep the peace in Gaza when the fighting stops? Who is going to pay for reconstruction? And how do we give the Palestinians what they call a horizon, the prospect of their own state in due course? That's got to be the route to de-escalation. That then opens up the opportunity for Israel to resume what it was doing, which is making bilateral links with individual Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia. All that helps to isolate Iran in the region. And that is, I think, the point where Israeli, moderate Arab, European, American interests come together.
But as international diplomacy goes into overdrive, it's one obvious question here, Gabby. What happens if Donald Trump becomes the president again?
That gift to international diplomacy. I mean, I think there is a very strong incentive on both sides of the Atlantic. You know, you have both the UK and US governments are running out of time electorally, to speak. And that awareness of that transition coming up is affecting negotiations. And I think it's one of the reasons that David Cameron has been so hyperactive, really, is to kind of project the idea that this isn't a dead UK government. So there is, you know, an incentive to try and get the Middle East peace process back on a secure footing before
Donald
Trump
returns.
Arrives. But whether, you know, the Middle East plays to that timetable, I don't know.
how terrified are you, Peter, about Donald Trump returning?
I'm pretty worried. And actually,
on this issue specifically?
Well, I think the real, real problem with Trump coming back is not on this issue, it's on Ukraine.
Right, okay, we'll come on to Ukraine in a minute. Could be argued that the one silver lining on the Donald Trump cloud was the Abraham Accords, which settled down Israel's relations with more friendly Arab states, right? So it might not be quite the disaster. I'm trying to be devil's advocate here a bit, but it might not be quite the disaster of the return of Trump that it's cracked up to be.
You never know with this man where he will come out.
I worry that you do know.
Well, I try not to know. I mean, I gather that he was furious with Netanyahu for coming out early in support of Biden at the time of the last presidential election. So he's very uncertain about this. It would be much better to get to a situation where the fighting was over in Gaza. Heavens above, it's still 9 months or something before a Trump would actually enter the White House. We surely can't have the war in Gaza going on that long. If we're into post-conflict period in Gaza, that does allow people to focus back on the issue of Ukraine, which is central to our security in this country and where Donald Trump could be a real threat.
Gabby, there is obviously a fear as this conflict spreads, if this conflict spreads, it will take further attention, coverage and potentially resources away from the Ukraine-Russia conflict, which is exactly what Vladimir Putin wants.
I think that's felt at all levels. That's felt, you know, Zelensky has publicly said. I remember at the start of this war, the Americans were asked, you know, is this going to take your focus off Ukraine? And the answer was no, you know, we can walk and chew gum, you know, we can manage two conflicts. I wouldn't say that's necessarily proved true over the intervening months.
The reality is that the Europeans cannot supplant what the Americans have been providing for Ukraine. Maybe they can on the economic side, but they certainly can't on the military side. So this package that is still stuck in the House of Representatives is crucial. Now it links both support for Israel, support for Ukraine, and sanctions on Iran in the latest proposal from the Speaker, Mr. Johnson. I mean, if that passes, then at least we've got to the end of the year. If it doesn't, then I think Ukraine is going to be falling back further and further as the relentless Russian offensive continues. And that is extremely bad news for all of us in Europe, because if in the end this comes out in a messy kind of frozen conflict with Ukraine not having seemed to have clearly come out on top, the implications for European security are very serious. If you go to anywhere on the front line, the Baltic states, the Nordic states, Poland, they are acutely worried about that.
And also there are things to be said here, aren't there, about Russia's relationship with Iran and so on, and the idea that you can see that glowering divide within the politics of Europe there latently in the Middle East as well, right?
Yes. I mean, the fact that Iranian drones are both being used in Ukraine and also fired at Israel, I think shows, you know, what they have built up in the way of offensive weapons. And that has now become an issue that the Europeans and Americans are thinking about further sanctions on. But yeah, the axis between Russia and Iran is crucial. China has an interesting role to play here. China now has a very close relationship with Iran. I don't think China wants to see the escalation going any further. You know, Iran moving to close the Straits of Hormuz would be extremely bad news for China as well as for the West. So perhaps we should all be talking more to China and getting them to use their influence in Tehran. But yes, the axis between Tehran and Moscow is something that we're all going to have to pay much more attention to in future.
Right. Now you've widened the conversation out to this terribly troubled and conflicted world. That leads me on to a point which might be a bit more emotional than political. But once this started to happen, October the 7th, I mean, Israel's attacks on Gaza, now this, at the same time as Ukraine is in the mess that it's in. I just have this rising sense, and I don't know what the political answer to this is, that it makes me feel even worse about Brexit, that there is a sense of the world being very combustible and fragile and riven with conflict of one kind or another. And that's at a time like that, that's exactly when the UK should be part of very strong international alliances, and we should sort of take refuge in large power blocks and all that. And we're just not in that position. It makes me feel more unsafe somehow. And I've got no right to talk about feeling unsafe in this very pacified, nice, comfortable corner in Northern Europe. But you know what I mean.
I mean, I'm never not depressed by Brexit, as you know, and never not regretting it. But actually, in a way, this last few, the sense that we are living in a more dangerous world, that danger is coming close to us, that it's on our doorstep, that it's in Europe, in a way makes me feel more hopeful that as a result, European defence and security comes to the forefront. We have a natural coalition of interests with our other, with what used to be our EU partners, that even if we don't cooperate through formal EU mechanisms anymore, we have had to cooperate over the defence of Ukraine. And that in a way that becomes our sort of beginnings of our path back into the family, that the more we see our interests in common with other EU capitals and the more, you know, our defence and foreign ministers are talking, that feels to me, I hate to say it's a silver lining because you can't, how can you have a silver lining to a war? It's ridiculous, but I feel in some ways that's encouraging.
There's no doubt that Brexit has diminished Britain's role and influence in the world. Both the fact that we left the EU at this very difficult time, as the world fractures into different blocks, and the way it was done, and the consuming effect on British politics for years meant we were off the agenda. So we've got a lot of ground to make up. Can I make a plug for a report by the House of Lords European Affairs Committee, which I chair, which produced a report in January on the impact of Ukraine on UK's relations with the EU? And actually, it bears out what Gabby said. The fact of war in Europe has brought us back together again with our EU counterparts, at least in foreign affairs and security and defence. Issues like sanctions, we've worked well with them together. So taboos that were there have come down to some extent. Not a complete rejoining of the parts on defence policy particularly. So I think that that is going to continue. I think faced with war in Europe, we will pull closer to our European counterparts. And I think the possibility of Trump arriving in the White House will be another incentive for Britain and the EU to get back together again in a closer and more rational partnership than we've got at the moment. Let me put it diplomatically like that.
Yeah. Come back to what you know. You've made me feel slightly better. Thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thanks a lot for having me.
I've made you feel slightly worse, as usual.
No, I think you're being hard on yourself, Gabby. Anyway, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, Gabby and I will be looking at some of this week's ups and downs as far as domestic politics is concerned. And yes, that does include Liz Truss. Welcome back. Gabby is still with me, and we're going to briefly look at what else has been happening this week in British politics. An embarrassment of riches.
An embarrassment, certainly.
Rishi Sunak's tobacco and vapes bill, which aims to create the UK's first smoke-free generation, or generations, plural, got a nod through its first reading in the House of Commons on Tuesday night. For anyone who doesn't know, the bill would stop anyone born after 2009 from buying cigarettes. Which does conjure up the spectacle of people eventually, you know, aged 38 not being able to buy cigarettes while those aged 39 can, to pick an example. Whether you agree with this legislation or not, it would certainly be a significant public health policy if it goes through to law. Here's my position. I think this legislation is absurd.
Well, I disagree with you, actually.
All right. Well, shall I tell you why I think it's absurd? Cool. Quickly. It's the first time, as far as I understand it, the legislation has proposed to put up a completely arbitrary division between adults in this country over what they can buy. It seems to me to be unenforceable. If you want to smoke, a large part of me thinks that's your right to do that, as misguided and daft as that may be, notwithstanding public health measures quite rightly to sort of dissuade you from doing so. And if this legislation goes through, it seems to me you'll get a huge shadow tobacco market controlled by fairly unpleasant people.
Well, I think you're wrong on the first two. I mean, the idea that no, I don't. I mean, the idea that we've never before had two different classes of adults.
Well, when have
one
we
has
had it before?
Well, if you look at everything from, you know, the introduction of tuition fees, you've got kids at one end of a university who are not paying, and kids coming in
the
first year.
But not
year
on
who
the
are.
Basis of
no,
age.
You've got yes, on the basis of when you were born, if you're unlucky, or if you took a year out or not. We have exactly the same with pension age entitlement, for example. You know, depending on when you were born, you might be retiring later, you might be whatever. We have it again and again and again. It's often the case when you have a new law introduced, you have a generation who just got under the wire and a generation who missed it.
Why not just ban it in 5 or 10 years' time?
Because
I think would be crazy.
I think,
but it wouldn't
way,
be as absurd as this.
I think this way, firstly, they think it's a softer target. But secondly, if you ban it in 10 years' time for everybody, you're banning people who are already addicted to tobacco. This was a measure aimed at stopping people ever starting. And that, I think, is fairer to people who are already smokers.
But you're still arguing on a fairly sort of theoretical ground here. In terms of whether the legislation will be enforceable, how is that going to work?
I don't think it's going to
be... So you just take your passport with you whenever you go and buy cigarettes to prove that you're 38.
Okay, we're starting with 15-year-olds who are already used to demonstrating proof of age. You know, in looking ahead to sort of where it gets more complicated is in 15 years' time, are you really going to be saying to 30-year-olds or 31-year-olds,
yes,
show me you're 30?
Yes.
You know, there I can see there are... Although it's not that much more difficult than Challenge 25, which is the existing policy on alcohol. You're supposed to challenge anyone, not just people who look 18,
but
anyone who looks under 25.
Aren't you, what are you going to get?
This will apply, to everybody. And I think by the time you get to sort of Challenge 48-year-olds, I think the assumption is that by then, tobacco isn't really going to be a thing.
But what if, at least in the sort of medium term, it's a thing which a lot of people can't buy? And we all know what happens with Prohibition. Because the absolute awful, obscene, tragic mess that is drugs policy in this country.
But I don't think, I mean, there's already an illicit trade in, you know, black market fag service, escape tax duty,
you're
smuggling them over
more.
The border from Ireland. Well, no, not really, because you're banning them for a specific age group. I think this is a measure, it's one of the few good things that are sort of dying prime minister with no authority otherwise and no real option to change anything can do, which is leave something that future governments will be grateful for. In 50 years' time, we're going to be looking at the lung cancer rates and looking at the heart disease rates and going, what were these kids doing in their teens that was different?
Well, perhaps in 50 years' time, we'll have used the same logic on other things.
Well, great. I wish we would.
Really? What, you think we should have age-differentiated purchase of fatty foods
I think what we should do is public health interventions which pay off in the long term. The kind of thing that governments are always criticised for not doing, because people think you're just only interested in things that will pay off you in 2 years' time. You're not interested in things that deliver a long-term benefit.
My 14-year-old daughter already thinks smoking is ludicrous. It's such a strange thing to do, and she's never going to do it. And that has happened because of clever, relatively subtle measures like ramping up the price of cigarettes, the smoking ban and so on, which have meant that it takes care of itself. Doing something as clunky
I think this is another... I mean, I think the most important bit of the bill for the age group our kids are the vaping provisions, because that's what they actually do. They vape, don't smoke. And I think it's totally unarguable that, you know, you should have controls on packaging. You should have controls on flavour.
No,
if you're selling bubblegum vapes...
That.
That look
but
like
I was in the mood for an argument
things,
today.
You know?
And Let's have another one, maybe. Can we talk about NatCon in Brussels? So this new right-wing international grouping, National Conservatism, a.k.a. NatCon, tried to hold a conference in Brussels, featuring, among other people, Suella Braverman and the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. But that fell into chaos on Tuesday after the mayor of Brussels tried to shut the conference down, claiming that, quote, the far right is not welcome here, unquote. Braverman and Farage said that their treatment was like something from Soviet Russia. Here's a bit of an irate Nigel Farage bemoaning what happened.
It's monstrous. A very decent, respectable group of people, members of the European royal family, prime ministers, academics, business people, being told they can't have an alternative view. Thank God for Brexit.
Well, can I just ask, the local mayor says it's because of fears over anti-abortion, possibly anti-gay sentiments held by people in the building.
Cobblers.
Two issues here. First of all, I've written about this relatively recently, whether we should be surprised that Suella Braverman, still ostensibly the member of the party of government, allegedly a part of the political mainstream, is sharing a platform with Viktor Orban. That's one question.
Unfortunately,
does
I'm not
tell
surprised.
You something about where quite a large chunk of conservatism is going, which is terrifying.
I'm more surprised that Michael Gove was due to speak at this conference, serving member of cabinet
yeah,
for this
yeah,
lot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that I find quite shocking.
Yeah, yeah. And worrying.
Yeah.
Because these people could be in even further charge of the Conservative Party.
I do. You know, it is an extreme ideological version of conservatism that conservatives 10 years ago would not have recognised, and it is scary how quickly it's becoming mainstreamed, I would say.
Okay, we agree on that.
Right.
Do we agree on the shutting down of the conference? Because I don't. I think this is a bad week for dangerous precedents, and this was another one of them. Let them have their conference.
I think, my God, we agree again. I think... I think if you believe in freedom of speech, you have to believe in people's mad people's freedom to say mad things in coalition with other mad people in their own sort of mad setting. And I think, you know, I bow to the Belgian police's better knowledge of what the public order implications were in Brussels.
But also a bit of public order worry comes in the business of politics,
comes
right?
With the business.
If you're going to get a bit of argy-bargy at a conference, that's for the police to
and
take
I
care
think
of. Doesn't
the main,
stop the conference.
I think the main problem with trying to shut it down has been that it's got far more publicity as a result.
Yeah,
and Nigel Farage has been able to go on television and say, oh, you know, the deep state is shutting us down and all the rest of it. It just makes that particular sort of ideological corner of the right, which loves to feel victimised and put upon and suppressed and, oh, we can't talk about immigration, you know, it just gives them
the ideal
fuel for
outcome,
all of that.
Isn't it?
And they've got great publicity. So,
totally.
You know, all in all, not great.
Right. Talking of that strand, among others, of conservative politics, let's talk about Liz Truss, the author of smash hits, including the mini budget that added thousands to your home mortgage and the shortest time in office in living memory, is back. She has returned, like Banquo's ghost or something, with her book, modestly titled 10 Years to Save the West. You've read some of the book, Gabby, is that correct?
I have. I think... The fascinating thing, I mean, it's sort of fascinating and appalling in equal measure to see Liz Truss come back. I mean, I don't think the Labour Party could be any more thrilled if it tried. You know, the sight of Liz Truss galumphing all over the place, just reminding everyone what absolute chaos she unleashed in office and how very kind of not sorry she is for any of it. I mean, I think they're literally cheering in the aisles. That's the perfect backdrop to the election for the Labour Party. I mean, the sort of power of Liz Truss is self-confidence despite everything.
So watching her this week, I felt a bit sort of troubled by it somehow, because you talk about this ostensibly strident sense of self-confidence, but there's something sort of fragile about her as well, in the sense that she seems to have come to the conclusion that she's only got two options, one of which to hold her hand up and go, I did everything wrong, and the other is just to double down hugely. And so she's doubling down. And there's something a bit tragic about that, in as much as it feels very unconvincing. Do you know what I mean? She looks... She doesn't look entirely comfortable coming out with all this stuff somehow.
It isn't very convincing. I mean, I think I agree with you on that.
Am I allowed to say sorry for her?
I mean, you can... are we just been talking about free speech? You're entitled to say that you feel sorry for her.
But as my old history teacher used to say, speaking as a human being, do you know what I mean? If you take politics out of it, it's really... horrible, sad thing. And the fact she's subjecting herself to this level of public ridicule, I mean, she chooses to do
but
so.
But she doesn't have to subject herself to that level. She could choose to go away for a year, think it through, come back with something more considered. She could have chosen to respond in different ways. Reading the book, you do feel a bit, you know, did her editor not occasionally step in and rescue her from herself? There is a tendency
Do you know how much money she was paid for writing this book?
I know.
She was paid £1,500, right?
They're not expecting it to be a bestseller, but there is something of the sort of missing safety catch about Liz Truss.
Right, here's my last Liz Truss point, right? And I will give credit to, although I've forgotten the name, the person who made this point on Twitter as I read on the train this morning, which I thought was really interesting. That what Liz Truss is doing is a classic example of something very overlooked and very modern. We have a culture, largely or partly because of social media, that encourages people, that almost makes people double down, right? To apologise and admit you were wrong is not a modern way to behave, right? Because it would invite mockery from your own side, from all your Twitter followers who expect you to play a type. So you play at the online gallery and you resolve your cognitive dissonance, this sense that I was right and yet everything went wrong. You resolve that by blaming everything on outside forces and other people, right? The deep state and all that, which then makes all your followers on social media love you even more. And in that sense, this is a quintessential modern political story. I like that theory.
It is. And I think that's right. And I think the language that she uses, the very conspiratorial language that she uses about the deep state, you're trying to stop me doing everything, you know, that is very contemporary. I would just say, though, that to see Liz entirely as a sort of creation of modern social media and modern politics, you know, I first met her when she became an MP in 2010. She was like that then. She's like that now.
And if you look at those videos of her when she was a teenage Lib Dem activist, there was a flavour of the same person, right? A very strong flavour. That's what she's like. Rock solid certainty about everything.
Yes.
I'm thinking she's eternally correct.
And also a tendency to want to go against the grain and to think that, you know, that there's a higher sort of intellectual quality to going against the grain than just sticking with the obvious what everyone thinks, except sometimes what everyone thinks is what everyone thinks.
And to widen this out beyond her and make a bigger political point that goes back to something you said about NatCon, the vocabulary that she's speaking in is paranoid, right? and takes her out to the fringes of right-wing politics. But it is mainstream within the Conservative Party. That's the point, right? That the vocabulary of the deep state and endless conspiracies and the idea of the blob, which is a Michael Gove invention that goes back at least a decade, very, very central to conservative thinking now. And again, it's odd to sense that being as mainstream
as it is politically.
Well,
I would say it's becoming mainstreamed. It's not yet mainstream. You know, Sunak and his sort of people don't use it. It's not that mainstream.
You're a bit boiling
but it's
frog,
much
though.
More.
Hold on a minute. If a recent prime minister is using it,
and
there are large political gatherings, but there are large political gatherings in Brussels, at which the Hungarian Prime Minister speaks and a recent Home Secretary turns up, then it's a bit boiling frog
but
to say
it's
not
saying,
in the mainstream.
I didn't say it wasn't in. I said it was becoming mainstream.
Ooh,
I did not
here.
Say it was central to government. It's becoming mainstream. That actually it is completely mainstream in US politics. And that's where I think she is targeting now. We are moving in that direction as far as the politics of centre-right are concerned, but look what's happening to the politics of centre-right. Look where the politics of the centre-right are in the polls. That's why I wouldn't say, oh, it's become mainstream, that's it, you know, it's unstoppable now.
Well, until Keir Starmer perhaps hits the buffers and it might be back in government. Which is
might be a while before Keir Starmer
prospect.
Starts talking
well, we'll
about
talk about
the
that.
Deep state.
We'll talk about that another time. I must say, for a full deep dive on Liz Truss's book and The Smoking Ban, you can listen to our sister podcast Today in Focus, wherever you get your podcasts. Gabby, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you out there for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier. And the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.